This is DZPN, the Drunken Zombie Podcasting Network.
Hello, this is Sylvia Schultz, your host for Lights Out. Thanks so much for joining me. I have been having so much fun doing these shows for you. It's such a pleasure being able to share the paranormal with you all. Thanks for listening. For Halloween, I had the privilege of scaring your socks off, I hope, with the tale of the house that isn't there. For Christmas, we're going to do something entirely different. Ghost hunters are a fun-loving bunch of folks. Let's face it, we sit around in the dark, asking questions of people we can't see, hoping we get answers we can't hear. We're an odd lot. We pretty much have to have a good sense of humor. So, here is my Christmas present to all of you, the lighter side of Lights Out. Ghost stories have been around for thousands of years. I was a classics major in college, and I was absolutely delighted to discover, in my reading, an ancient Roman ghost story. This story was written down by Pliny the Younger around 100 AD. I found this translation on the Ancient Standard website, ancientstandard.com, so it's thanks to them that I'm going to read this to you in English and not in Latin. An ancient Roman ghost story, in translation from the original Latin, as originally recorded by Pliny the Younger. There was in Athens a house, large and spacious, which had a bad reputation as though it was filled with pestilence. In the dead of night, a noise was frequently heard, resembling the clashing of iron, which, if you listened carefully, sounded like the rattling of chains. The noise would seem to come from a distance away, but it would start coming closer and closer and closer. Immediately after this, a specter would appear in the form of an old man, emaciated and squalid, with bristling hair and a long beard, and rattling the chains on his hands and feet as he moved. The unfortunate inhabitants of the house went sleepless at night due to unimaginable and dismal terrors. Without sleep, as it had happened to others, their health was ruined, and they were struck with some kind of madness. As the horrors in their minds increased, they were led on a path towards death. Eventually, even during the daytime when the ghost did not appear, the memory of their nightmares was so strong that it still passed before their eyes every waking moment. Their terror was constant, even when the source of the fear was gone. Because of this, the house was eventually deserted and damned as uninhabitable, abandoned entirely to the ghost. In hope that some tenant might eventually be found who was ignorant of the house's malevolence, a bill was still posted for its sale. As it happened, a philosopher by the name of Athenodorus came to Athens at that time. Reading the bill for the house, he easily discovered the price, and, being an intelligent man, he was suspicious at its extremely low cost. Someone did tell him the whole story, and yet he wasn't dissuaded, but was instead eager to make the purchase. Thus, he did. When evening drew near, Athenodorus asked for a couch to be readied for him at the front of the house. He asked for his writing materials and a lamp, and then asked his retainers to retire for the night. In order to ensure that his mind stayed focused and away from distractions of stories about imaginary noises and apparitions, he poured all his energy into his writing. For a while, the night was silent. Then the rattling of fetters began. Athenodorus would not lift his eyes or set down his pen. Instead, he concentrated on his writing and thereby closed his ears. But the noise wouldn't stop, and it only increased and drew closer until it seemed to be at the door and then standing in his very chamber. Finally, Athenodorus looked away from his work and saw the ghost standing just as it had been described. It stood there, waiting, beckoning him with one finger. Athenodorus held up his palm as though the visitor should wait a moment, and once again bent over his work. The ghost, impatient, shook his chains over the philosopher's head, beckoning again. This time, Athenodorus picked up his lamp and followed the ghost as it moved slowly, as though it was held back by his chains. Upon reaching the courtyard, the ghost suddenly vanished. Now on his own, Athenodorus carefully marked the spot where the ghost vanished with a handful of leaves and grass. The following day, he asked the magistrate to have that spot dug up, and in that spot was found, intertwined with chains, the skeleton of a man. The body had lain in the ground a long time and had left the bones bare and corroded by the fetters. The bones were then collected and given a proper burial at public expense. And, since the ghost's tortured soul had been finally laid to rest, the house in Athens was haunted no more. I've just always loved the imagery in that story. The drafty old house, the specter wandering into the room, rattling his chains to get Athenodorus's attention. Then, the philosopher, not even looking up from his manuscript, holding up a finger for the ghost to wait. Hang on a sec. Carthago delenda est, sic semper tyrannis, semper ubi sub ubi. Okay, what'd you need? My husband Rob patiently endures my late nights and ghost hunting, and my breathless recap of the highlights of the evening. He doesn't believe in ghosts. As a matter of fact, he wisely points out that there is more evidence for the existence of dinosaurs than there is for the existence of ghosts. To this end, he decided to start a new hobby and form his own dinosaur hunting group.
It's our first dinosaur hunt. There's five of us. Various large rifles, some fedoras, lots of khaki. And we're in downtown Peoria. There haven't been any sightings in a long time, but we're going to sit here at the coffee shop, drinking cappuccinos, and we're just going to see what happens. We've talked to the owners, they're okay with it, and we might at some point go, what you call lights out. Basically, we take a 5-gallon bucket of blood and we spill it on the floor, and then we knock the tables over, hide behind with the weapons out, and see what happens. So we'll see if we can get any sightings. Bill's awful excited. He's got a new gun. It's a full automatic, belt-fed Vickers, and he's really looking forward to trying that out and see how it does. So he's set up behind some sandbags in the corner. So looks like another round of cappuccinos are here. We're all getting really twitchy and hyper. We'll see how this goes.
The last time I was at the Pollock Hospital in Bartonville, I hung out with a group of ladies who had come down from Chicago to do some ghost hunting with American Hauntings. One of them shared her story with me.
My name is Dawn Santos, and my funny little ghost story is after my brother had passed away, he knew how I did not like for anything to be on the floor in my house. He knew that it bothered me when trash or garbage. So his big joke to me all the time when he was alive was to always throw things on the floor to watch me walk behind him and pick it up. So after he passed away, the whole first week, we would always hear this clunk clunk in my dining room and a candle just roll off the table and onto the floor. And I didn't think anything of it the first, couple times it happened. We were like, that's weird. But then it kept happening over and over again. I'm like, why does this keep happening? So we even played with it to see, could the candle just pop out? Could it roll off the table? Is the table slanted? Nothing. Mm-hmm. And this went on for a whole week. He would keep knocking it out. It'd keep falling to the ground several times a day. And then after a week, it just stopped. And now the candles just sit in my... I get chills every time I say, yeah. But, you know, and I tell people that story and they don't... always believe it. They're like, oh, it was probably just a defaulted candle. But no, the same candles sit in the same holders on my table. So that was his way to say that I'm here and don't worry, I'm safe. So it was a good story. Yeah, it was a good story. It was a fun story. So
it was a comforting story. That's why I tell people, you know, I know you might not believe in life afterwards, but there's a way. If you're very sensitive and you listen to them saying, I'm here, you know, they tell you that there. So it's very cool.
Thank you for sharing that with me.
The ghosts at the Pollock are known for their playful sense of humor. The same night I heard the candlestick story, Chris Morris, who is in charge of the Pollock, was walking through the building around midnight, checking on the groups of ghost hunters who were scattered throughout different parts of the building. She walked into the men's death ward, moving quietly because the lights were off. She figured a group was in there investigating, until she heard snoring. There are bed-sized benches in the men's ward, and investigators often lie down on them to get a better sense of what it might have been like to be a patient there. Chris just figured, hey, it's late. Maybe one of the group lay down and nodded off. After a whispered warning, she turned on the lights, only to find the men's ward empty. Jackie, one of the volunteers at the Pollock Hospital, had her own run-in with the playful spirits in the building.
Okay, Jackie is going to tell the story of her encounter at the Pollock Hospital with a handsy spirit. And I'll clean this up and edit it.
Okay. We had a work night. And we were having a ball. We were having fun listening to music. Mm-hmm. And we were having a break afterwards. And all the kids were sitting in the room. And I'm standing at the door jamb, just leaning there. And all of a sudden, there's a hand on my butt. A hand. Because there are four fingers and a thumb. And I'm like, I'm looking at all the kids going, okay, this ain't right. Everybody's accounted for. I turn around. Nobody's there. And so, okay. That's cool. And I've had it happen again, too.
Really?
In a different circumstance, yes. Yes. Very playful spirit.
Very cool.
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks.
My business partner, David Youngquist, has a delightful story, one of my favorites, about a Pollock ghost he encountered while simply driving past the building.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. This is about George, on Sylvia's request. He's an interesting gentleman. I was down to visit Sylvia in Pekin one day and was on a route to go and donate some books to different libraries. And I had not been to the Bartonville Asylum. I'm not from Central Illinois, so I'm not real familiar with that area. And so to me, all this research is very cool and very new. And I have enjoyed reading the stories and reading the book as it's come out. Not let alone publish it. You know, it's been a blast. But, you know, so it's kind of new territory for me. And so when I asked Sylvia, you know, how do I get to such and such libraries? She said, okay, you go up here and you turn left and you go up this hill and you go right past the asylum. I'm like, okay, fine. So I'm driving the truck, and luckily enough at that time I had a truck that was an automatic because my little stick shift would have driven me nuts going up that hill. But I'm going up the hill and there's these giant, massive buildings up about halfway up the hill. And Sylvia had let me know to put my sensor, my shields up, because she knows how sensitive I am and that things get kind of wonky sometimes. So as I'm driving up past these buildings, all of a sudden I get this presence sitting beside me in the cab of my truck. And it's an older gentleman, and he's not breathing real well. You know, he's kind of got a real raspy, lungy breathing pattern. And I'm like, hello? And he said, hello. I'm like, I'm David. Who are you? And he kind of took another breath. Said, my name's George. I'm like, okay. How are you? He's like, I'm all right. I'm like, okay. I said, George, do you live around here? Did you live around here? He's like, I was a patient at the hospital. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, he said, I used to farm, but I got tuberculosis and I had to go to the hospital, and that's where I died. And at that time, I didn't know that Bartonville had a TB wing. So I pulled out my phone, and I shouldn't be driving and texting. I know, bad boy. I texted Sylvia. I said, did this hospital at one time have a tuberculosis ward? And you, of course, Sylvia texted me back, said, yes, it did. And you gave me the name, I think, of what it was.
Pollock Hospital.
Pollock Hospital. And said, and you asked me why. And I said, I'll explain later. So I hung up the phone, or got done texting, put it aside. I said, George, why are you with me? And he kind of looked at me, and he was this typical old-fashioned farmer. He's wearing a bib overalls, a straw hat. He had a pair of the horn-rimmed glasses, which I forgot to tell you when I talked to you. He had a pair of the old horn-rimmed glasses. And he had been a big guy at one time, but the TB had kind of eaten him up. You know, he had the big knobby hands and the big broad shoulders. And you could, you know, you could tell he was used to a life of hard work. And he looked at me, and he said, well, I don't get out much. And I'm like, okay, it's all I could do not to laugh. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't get out much? He said, well, he says, not too many people come by that can see me, for one. He said, and I just kind of didn't want to be here all day. He said, I noticed you going by, and I thought I'd go for a ride. I'm like, okay. I'm like, great, I now have a ghost following me around. And I said, all right, if you behave yourself, you can come with. Okay, you know, just a very agreeable guy. And he had died back in the 50s, and, you know, vehicles back then were, you know, they weren't as technologically advanced as what we have now. And so we got to, and my truck was an older, it was a 2001, so it wasn't, and it was just a base model, it had been a fleet truck. But it still got the digital radio, and it still got, you know, the wipers that have the paws, and so he was just, you know, just really having fun looking at all the buttons and all the stuff on my truck. And, you know, he wanted to know where the stick was. And I'm like, or wanted to know where the clutch was and the pedal, yeah, and all that. I'm like, it's an automatic. He's like, what's an automatic? And I'm like, okay, and I had to explain automatic transmissions to him. He was like, well, that's interesting. He said, you don't have any trouble with this hill anymore then, do you? I'm like, no. You know, so it was just kind of this weird conversation of catching him up 50 years.
That's fun.
and he was telling me, you know, what was here and what was there, and, you know, this wasn't here before, and so, you know, we're kind of playing what he died knowing and what now had changed. And so we got around the horn, made the turn, went out towards the airport, and he didn't like the airplanes because it made too damn much noise. And I'm like, yeah, I agree with you on that one. And we went to the Limestone Library, and got out of the truck, parked, went in and talked to the library director, gave her catalog. And actually, the gal that I needed to talk to was halfway busy because she was doing something with a children's group and trying to run the desk because somebody had called off.
Oh, no.
And so about the last thing she wanted to do was deal with me. So I said, that's all right. Do what you have to do. We'll talk as we go. So George, in the meantime, had followed me into the library. And he's out in the stacks, and he's out wandering around. He's looking at the computers, and he's looking at the audio equipment, and he's just having a ball. And I'm trying to not say out loud, George, leave that alone. Don't touch the computer. Don't mess with the radio, please. You know, it's like having a kid, you know, because all this stuff is so cool to him. You know, moving pictures in a box. This is really neat, you know. Like, and so I'm trying not to be obviously distracted talking to the librarian for fear that she's going to think I'm a real nut job and keep him from messing with the technology, because ghost energy, spirit energy does not mesh well with technology. I have found this to be the case more than once. President Grant likes to play with computers in Galena, and he's fried more than one. He is not a technologically known person. He's not good with technology. And this is from the gal that works at the depot in Galena.
Okay.
President Grant has fried more than one computer by messing with it. So George is kind of doing the same thing. He's kind of floating around here and there, and I'm, you know, I'm doing like the little kid thing, the parent thing. Don't do it. You know, and so I finally get done talking to the librarian. I donate the books. And I'm thinking, I hope I didn't embarrass myself too much. And you know, said, please, you know, consider us in the future for buying books. And she thanked me profusely for the books that I donated and everything. And then she had, I mean, she was extremely busy. And so we kind of parted ways. I walked back out of the parking lot, and George is following, thank God. I didn't have to go after him. And he was walking beside me, and he was just giddy with all this neat stuff that there is in the library. And so we got in the truck, headed back down the road. And I'm like, you're not going to follow me home, are you? He's like, no, I'm not supposed to go off the grounds. And I'll stay here. Like, okay. I said, so how much longer are you going to ride with me? Because, you know, Limestone to your place, to where you live and to where I'd met you that day is a few miles apart.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, are you okay now? He's like, oh, yeah, I'm fine. I'm not anywhere I'm not supposed to be.
Yeah, because the Alpha Park Library is actually on what used to be the grounds.
Right, right. And you explained that to me later on. Because I was kind of worried about him following me, and when he said he was still all right, I'm like, okay, because I didn't know the history of the place. So we got going back down the road, and I turned, went back down the hill, and as we passed the Pollock, it would have been, all of a sudden he was gone again.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that, you know, he just kind of, you know, he said, thanks for the ride, I had a good time, and he was gone. Like, okay, that's one of the more interesting trips I've made.
Very cool.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. That was a fun day. That was a fun day.
Sometimes, of course, it's not necessarily a building that's haunted. Sometimes it's the land on which a building is built. David shared another story with me about a ghostly farmer who was none too pleased with the changes that had been made to his property in the years since he'd passed on.
So tell me about Elmer.
He's a trip. He, Ottawa, Utica, this whole area, for some reason, down the river, it's got to be something to do with the river and the native background that holds spirits here, but where the Silver Slipper sits is a gentleman's club. The Silver Slipper is a gentleman's club, and it used to be a farm sat there years ago. And I've had girls that are now friends of mine that worked there that have said they've seen this gentleman come in, walk through the door wearing bib overalls and a straw hat and work boots, and walk in through the door, and they would walk in behind and he was nowhere in there. But they've seen him walking in. And they told me this before I even opened my mouth about it. So it wasn't me asking questions. They found out I was a writer and said, hey, let me tell you this ghost story. And so they've actually seen him walk in doors and nobody's there. But he's possessive of his property, and he still is under the impression that his house still stands there. And he has come up to me because he knows that I can see him, and tried to convince me to get all these naked women out of his house because he doesn't know why all these naked women are in my house. If my wife comes home and sees all these naked women, I'm going to be in so much trouble. I was sitting at the bar one night just having a beer, minding my own business, and I'm sitting there, and you know, you get to know the girls and you get to be friends with them and that, and there's other ones that are just kind of on the periphery. It's just a normal kind of gentleman's club. And one of my friends had been there, and she up and left and went, and it was her turn on the stage. And I'm sitting there watching and just drinking my beer, not paying any attention. And so there's an empty seat next to me. And all of a sudden, Elmer shows up. And again, he's trying to convince me to get this woman out of his house. I'm like, dude, I can't help it. It's not your house anymore. You know, and I'm not carrying on this conversation like that, but I'm trying to discreetly say, you know, can't help, you know, there's nothing going on that isn't legal. It's not your house is gone. And one of the girls comes up and just wearing a little G-string and stocking, comes up and sits in the same chair that he's sitting in, and it was like Daffy Duck exploded. It's absolute pit. And I'm doing all I can to keep from laughing at this poor girl that just sat down. and she asked if I want to dance. I'm like, no, hon, that's okay. I'm just here for a beer and I'm talking to so-and-so. And after he got done having his conniption, he basically just kind of poof, blew up. Oh, my God. He's going to hate me so much. You know, but it's weird. It's weird how that kind of thing happens. Yeah.
I love ghost hunting. I love having fun and laughing. I especially love it when both of these things come together. One of my favorite EVP stories of all time is the tale of the ghost fart. My team, Research and Paranormal, and I had gone to Macomb, Illinois, for an investigation. Well, for a tour, really. And we were at the Little Stitches Sewing Shop in Macomb on the square. And we were having just a delightful time racing around the building, lights out, of course, and just wandering around, taking pictures, doing recording. And everybody on the team has their own job to do. Sherry is very, very good at taking photographs. Ursula is our video person. Gail's our tech person. And I did the recording and then turned the DVR over to Gail to work with the recordings afterwards. So Sherry and I were in the back room on the first floor of the building with the guide. Everyone else had gone back to the front room. And the guide said, "Well, hold on a minute. I think I heard some hangers rattling over on the wall." So Sherry and I are standing there. Sherry's standing to my right, and she's snapping pictures. And I'm standing there with my flashlight in my left hand and my recorder in my right hand. And Sherry's snapping pictures. I'm standing there recording. And all of a sudden, from my left, I hear somebody fart. Now, it's not some pants-shredding blast or anything like that. It's this tiny, polite little poot. Now, I have the sense of humor of a 10-year-old boy. So my first reaction when I heard this was, somebody farted. So I pulled myself together, you know, professional ghost hunter. I'm not supposed to come unglued when somebody breaks wind or anything. So we decided to rejoin the rest of the group in the front room. So Sherry wrapped up her picture taking, and I turned on the flashlight to help us find our way back to the front room. And just out of morbid curiosity, I turned the flashlight to my left. And that's when I realized that not only was nobody standing next to me, I was standing next to a solid wall. I said, "Oh, okay, I think people need to know about this." That's what you do when you're on an investigation and something weird happens. You tell everybody about it. So we get back to the front room. And I say, "All right, I know everyone's going to laugh at me, but this is what I heard." And I described the ghost fart. And I knew it was going to happen. Everyone is just rolling on the floor. "Oh, right, you heard a ghost fart. Whatever. Oh, yeah, we really believe you." I said, "Okay, you know what? I stand by my experience. This is what I experienced, and that's that." So that was Saturday night. When we got home, I gave my DVR to Gail for her to download the sounds and play with them and everything. And Sunday morning, Gail sends me a text. She goes, "I found your ghost fart on the tape." And I said, "I told you so." I texted back, "Told you so." That was Sunday morning. And Sunday afternoon, she sent me an email. And she wasn't laughing quite so hard. She said, "You have to listen to this." So she sends me two sound files. And I click on the first one. Now tell me that doesn't sound like a fart. I'll play it one more time. And once more in case you missed it. And then I played the second file. To me, what that sounds like is a voice saying, "Hello?" What Gail had done is taken that sound file and slowed it down 300%. And I tell you what, the first time I heard that, the goosebumps just started at my fingers and raced up to my shoulders, and I was not expecting that at all. And
my first reaction was, oh my gosh, I'll never be able to go back to that that store again, because, man, now I know there's something there. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that, you know, here's something that wanted to communicate with us so badly that she was able to make a noise that came out on the recorder, yes, but also a noise that I could hear with my naked ear. And that kind of made me feel better about the whole thing. The idea of somebody communicating. Thank you so much for joining me for a special holiday edition of Lights Out. For more stories, including funny ones, about the Pollock, be sure to check out Fractured Spirits, Hauntings at the Peoria State Hospital. And here's a hint, don't miss The Dirty Girl on page 147. There's a Facebook fan page for the book. Just look up Fractured Spirits on Facebook. While you're there, like the page. What the heck? You can also message me through the page. So if you liked this show or any other show, I'd love to hear from you. And if you have funny stories to share with me, share away. I'd love to hear them. Thank you all so much for listening. Here's wishing everyone a safe and happy holiday season. Be sure to join me next time. Who knows what fun tales are in store for the new year when we go Lights Out.